Today's episode is sponsored by One Medical, a modern primary care benefit employees use and love. Their mission is to make quality care more affordable, accessible, and enjoyable for all through a blend of human-centered design, technology, and an exceptional team.
Healthy buildings are not expensive and doesn't have to be hard. I think there's this notion out there that it's too expensive, too hard, it can only be the new shiny buildings. It's not true. Any building can be a healthy building. You're going to be pulled into this movement, whether you lead it or you get dragged into it by other forces.
That's Dr. Joseph Allen, an associate professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and co-author of Healthy Buildings, How Indoor Spaces Drive Performance and Productivity. Dr. Allen directs the Healthy Buildings program at Harvard, where he created the 9 Foundations of a Healthy Building. An internationally renowned expert, Dr. Allen's knowledge on healthy buildings has never been more in demand, with his work appearing frequently in the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, NPR, and the New York Times. I'm Ellen Kelsey, and this is a Business Group on Health podcast, conversations with experts on the most important health and well-being issues facing employers. Today, Dr. Joe Allen and I are going to discuss the importance of healthy buildings, both now and in the post-pandemic future. Dr. Allen, welcome. Delighted to have you with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to join you. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, I want to get right into it. You often start your presentations by talking about the 90% and specifically the 90% that we are ignoring. Can you elaborate more? What is the 90% and what do you mean about the 90% that we're ignoring?
Yeah, good pickup. I've been starting most of my presentations for going back many years now with that question. Why are we ignoring the 90%? And I talk about two parts of that. The first is we spend 90% of our time indoors, but we ignore that. We spend most of our time thinking about the 10% of where we spend our time. Like, you know, we have controls for outdoor air pollution. We have the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. We don't have a corollary for the indoor environment. So we've largely ignored that. And one way I think about that, or a way to get people to think about what that actually means for their health, is to take your age and multiply it by 90%, so 0.9. That's your indoor age. So no one likes doing the math publicly, or no one likes to disclose their age publicly, but I'll do mine. I'm 45. My indoor age is 40. So 40 years spent inside my office, my home, schools, in a car, in an airplane, in a hotel. So these indoor environments are just having an absolute massive impact on our health, but largely been ignored. And then quickly, the other side of the 90% we're ignoring is the true costs of operating our businesses. That's the people side of this. And I've come in from the green building movement where, you know, we focus mostly on that 10% or even the 1% of buildings, the energy, waste, water, all really important, but largely have ignored the true cost of operating our buildings. That's the people. So you put those together, we spend all of our time indoors. If we optimize buildings for health, we start to capitalize on that business side of buildings we're ignoring, the 90% cost, and that's the people.
That's so profound, and it's so amazing when you break it down and you talk about the time and the proportion of our lives that we spend indoors, but yet disproportionately how little we actually talk about that, let alone consciously plan and strive to create indoor climates that are healthy climates. And I imagine by extrapolation that climate indoor really does impact our well-being, our productivity, and ultimately our performance. Have you studied that? And is there a correlation?
Yeah, there's absolutely a relationship between the two. And in thinking about, you know, why we ignore this, I'll say most of the information we have on how buildings influence our health, our productivity, our well-being comes from really a couple dozen researchers around the world who focus on indoor environmental quality, as opposed to many hundreds or even thousands of researchers who focus on outdoor environmental quality. And back to that issue of this is being ignored, before I talk about the science here, if I asked you or anybody and said, well, what does it mean to live a healthy lifestyle? You'd tell me you have to exercise. You'd say I shouldn't smoke cigarettes. You'd say I have to eat a healthy meal. Outdoor air pollution is bad for us, but you wouldn't turn right to the indoor environment. And that gets to this issue of the science, right? Because it's buried science. It's been largely held up in academic journals, which most people don't hear about. It's not New England Journal of Medicine. It's not JAMA, but it's these journals that I'm an editor for, journals like the Journal of Indoor Air, but people didn't even know there was a journal dedicated to indoor air quality. And you start to look at all that science and you put it together with that 90% of where we spend our time. And then you start to realize just how much we're missing when we ask people what it means to lead a healthy life, and they don't first think of the indoor environment. Studies that show relationships between the amount of fresh air that comes into your house and lower rates of asthma attacks, for example, or better performance on cognitive function tests, or how lighting and views or biophilic design, this nature indoors, is associated with better creative thinking, quicker stress response recovery. I could go on and on, but there are hundreds of studies that show these links between indoor environmental quality and our health, but they've been largely buried in some of these more obscure journals.
Well, I love it. I think about all the time and money we spend thinking about indoor aesthetics, but we don't think about indoor quality the way that we should. And to your point, the science that really underscores that. And I've been so interested in your work, specifically the 9 foundations of healthy buildings that you've created. Can you share with the audience what those 9 foundational elements are?
Yeah, sure. So I'm glad you brought that up. You know, we've tried to synthesize this to say, okay, let's make sense of all the science that's out there. And we put together a report we call the 9 foundations of a healthy building. We have ventilation and air quality, thermal health, so temperature and relative humidity and how that influences our health, mold and moisture, dusts and pests, water quality, acoustics and noise, lighting and views, and also safety and security. And the idea for the 9 foundations of a healthy building actually came from a real estate conference. You know, at the end of a session I presented at, I said something to the effect, I think we're overcomplicating what it takes to have a healthy building. And a lot of people kind of leaned in. What does it take to make a healthy building? And the conversation continued after the presentation all the way through lunch. And that's when it struck me that a lot of this science was locked up in these academic journals, and we needed to produce a report that tried to synthesize it to say, what are the foundational elements of a healthy building? What does the science really tell us? And so we came up with this idea for the 9 foundations of a healthy building to try and explain this in really simple 2-page executive summaries. What is ventilation? Why does it matter for health? And what should you do?
That's great. And I love that it was at a real estate conference, and hopefully those developers and people that own the buildings are incorporating these 9 elements in all their new construction and remodels going forward, certainly. And certainly this past year, we've seen the importance of all of those aspects on worker safety and how they feel about potentially coming back to the workplace. And I want to pick up on perhaps the first one that you mentioned was related to ventilation. And we hear a lot about the importance of ventilation, certainly in this COVID era and a post-COVID potential return to the workplace environment. Can you speak, you know, perhaps a bit more extensively on ventilation, why it's so important, and what employers and workers should be thinking about as it relates to ventilation and coming back to the workplace in the future?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you're right. You know, like I think prior to COVID, there were a handful of good organizations thinking about how the green building movement was transitioning to healthy buildings. But clearly with COVID, it has the real estate world's attention. And one of the issues, of course, is the ventilation. But I think to understand why ventilation is so important in the context of infectious disease transmission, we have to take a quick step back and say, what do we know about how this virus is spread? And it's spread through the air. It's an airborne virus. Now, I've been yelling from the rooftops for 14 months. The first article I wrote was February 9th, 2020, talking about the power of healthy buildings as the first line of defense against this coronavirus, talking about the need for better ventilation, better filtration. But the problem is World Health Organization, CDC, and others were slow to acknowledge that airborne spread was happening. They were focused on surface transmission, or what we call fomites, and large droplets, so close contact transmission only. So it doesn't make sense to go out there and say, bring in more outdoor air if airborne transmission is not happening, right? If it's transmitted through surfaces, we don't say, well, open up the windows.
Yeah.
But the reality is all of the evidence supports that airborne transmission is happening. And let's say at this point, I think it's more widely recognized or finally accepted that airborne transmission is happening. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about near field and far field. Near being within a couple feet, and far field, transmission beyond this magical 6-foot buffer we've been talking about, or 2 meters. And so accepting that airborne transmission has happened, we have to recognize that as we produce respiratory aerosols that may carry the virus just from breathing, talking, singing, saying ah, these will accumulate indoors. And they'll stay aloft until they're removed through one of 2 mechanisms, really. One, they'll be diluted out of the air, removed through ventilation. The other is they can be cleaned out of the air through filtration. So we've seen time and again, every outbreak, really all the major outbreaks associated with time indoors, no masks, and low to no ventilation. You get the buildup of these respiratory aerosols. So this is why ventilation has become just so prominent, or such a focal point for schools and offices and homes and hospitals and really everywhere.
And you mentioned, you know, the schools and the hospitals and the workplaces. And if you were to give a letter grade of how well ventilated you think most of those spaces are today, would you give them an A, a B, a C, an F? And I'm sure it's hard to grade in aggregate, but generally speaking, are we properly ventilated or do we have a lot of ground to make up in terms of ventilation?
Well, I'll tell you honestly, we failed. I'll give it an F, but I'll say this. It's not the fault of the building owners or operators or developers or investors. The problem is the ventilation standards that we all design to and build to are outdated. They are not designed for health. In fact, I often point out that the standard that governs ventilation in buildings, schools, offices, everywhere, airplanes, is called the Standard for Acceptable Indoor Air Quality. Acceptable. It's in the name, right? It's not the standard for healthy indoor air quality. Mm-hmm. And so we know from decades of science that higher ventilation rates above these minimums provide many benefits, including reductions in infectious disease transmission and benefits that are more towards well-being and productivity. But right now, thinking about COVID, we've known that the current ventilation targets are insufficient. So this is why I give it an F, because everybody's underventilated, really, based on what the science says. But it's not their fault. They're not being negligent by doing this. It's just that's what the standard is. The problem is the standard hasn't been set for health, and I'd like to see that change.
And so what do? Recognizing that we are abysmally failing, and the standards were set where they were, but there is a need for kids to get back into school and for hospitals to remain operational and for eventually individuals to return back to a work site, as an example. What's the realistic remedy? Are there some stopgap measures we can do? Is this an overhaul entirely of ventilation? What should employers and other organizations be contemplating when it comes to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think of it in two parts. And maybe I'll talk about, you know, what do you do now in the middle of a crisis during COVID? And then what happens next? Like, what do we do as we hopefully get through COVID, at least in the US context? Things are looking good thanks to the vaccines. But in terms of what to do now, I actually think there are things that most organizations can do that are probably going to be less expensive than they think and don't require a massive overhaul. Mm-hmm. So I've been careful to give recommendations really along these three strategies. Bring in more outdoor air. So figure out what your building is currently doing and optimize that for outdoor air. Two, put better filters on the recirculated air. Typically, buildings have what's called a MERV 8 filter, MERV. That captures a pretty low percent of airborne particles. If you upgrade to a MERV 13, you're cleaning a lot more of that air. You're capturing maybe 80% of the particles. That's great. Three, if you can't do that, you're in a school, you can't open your windows, and you're an office building doesn't have operable windows, and you can't bring in more outdoor air, your system can't handle MERV 13 filters, you can really achieve the amount of clean air we recommend through the use of portable air cleaners with HEPA filters, right? If you size them right for the room, pick one with a good clean air delivery rate, you can actually provide plenty of not ventilation, but good clean air, clean in the sense that it'd be virus-free, as a total stopgap measure. And these don't have to be expensive. Now, one of the issues that's been out there is that, you know, people have said bring in more outdoor air without actually setting a target. So that's one of the things my team did last year and just published an article in JAMA 2 or 3 weeks ago recommending that in small volume places, you know, typical ceiling height rooms, 8 to 10, 12 foot ceilings, target 4 to 6 air changes per hour through any combination of more ventilation or better filtration. So that was a lot in my answer there, but in terms of the stopgap measures, yeah, there are things any organization can do right now to minimize the risk of that airborne spread in buildings.
And is there anything that an organization should not do that could actually make it worse?
There's a whole bunch of things they shouldn't do. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of it. I'd say first and foremost, you know, you just heard me kind of walk through the top three, bring in more outdoor air, better filters on the recirculated air, portable air cleaners with HEPA. I wouldn't go beyond that. You know, it's not a time we need some fancy new unproven technology. There's a lot on the market that's brand new. I'm not anti-technology. I actually like this. I advise organizations on new technology. But right now, it's really a time for the basics. And until something comes along that is better and is cost-effective, you know, for me, I'm recommending the things that we know that have a deep evidence base. I can tie it back to many peer-reviewed papers. Better ventilation, better outdoor air, that's going to help. We know this. Better filtration. portable air cleaners with HEPA. You don't, for the portable air cleaners, you really don't want any add-ons. You don't need any add-ons, right? They just add expense and they're not really adding anything in terms of benefit.
Mental and behavioral health issues affect millions of Americans. One out of every five people in the U.S. will be diagnosed with a mental health condition, and 57% of those won't receive any treatment. People bounce between providers and mental health resources with little to no guidance around how to find appropriate care. That's why we've launched Mindset by One Medical, a virtual first program with coaching, therapy, and group sessions with the exceptional One Medical primary care experience. Same or next day, in person or over video, your employees can get care quickly and avoid the typical wait to see a mental health provider. We improve clinical outcomes so your people are healthier, happier, and more productive. We reduce costs for companies by preventing unnecessary specialist visits and out-of-network referrals. One Medical is here to help your team feel their best emotionally because mental well-being is essential to overall health and wellness.
When you started answering kind of the first question there, you said, I'll answer about what to do now and then what to do kind of what's next, or perhaps a longer term thing that organizations can do to address ventilation beyond just the here and now.
Yeah. So, you know, I think things like portable air cleaners are great. Stopgap measure, plug and play. You can get these things anywhere, easy to size for the room. But I don't think the future of the office or schools or anywhere is going to have, you know, hundreds of these portable air cleaners plugged in. We have better solutions there. So I'd say the first thing you need to do is commission your building systems, right? And commissioning is, you know, if you're not familiar with that, it's basically making sure the building systems you have are operating correctly. It's like getting a tune-up for your car once a year. Just make sure it's operating right. One, we know that systems that are commissioned provide better indoor air quality. Two, it'll save you money. It saves energy. So this is just a good, simple first step. And part of that commissioning process or, you know, building assessment is just figuring out, what do you have? What kind of filters can you upgrade to? How old is the equipment? When's the last time you've had to give it a tune-up or put in these better filters? So basically figuring out what you can and can't do with your existing systems. And then you can make your capital improvement plan accordingly based on the end life of that system. What do you need to do to that system to bring in these higher ventilation rates that, as we think about beyond COVID or beyond infectious disease? Because right now we're focused on disease avoidance, right? But that's not health. Health is also flourishing. It's well-being. It's better cognitive function. And we know that these higher ventilation rates come with those other benefits. So in the interim, the stopgap right now of how do we prevent the spread of this virus indoors? But longer term, I don't just want good filtration. I want good ventilation as well, so I can capture these other benefits and go beyond the code minimums.
I'm so glad you brought up that point. And it is beyond just the stopgap measure of dealing with the spread of the virus and really ultimately getting towards living better, more fulfilling lives and having greater well-being. And you just mentioned cognitive function, and our team was also just so fascinated by the work of you and your team at Harvard on the connection between ventilation and cognitive function. Share what you saw there. What did you find?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting set of studies. We're on our third version of what we call the COG-FX studies for cognitive function. And in the first one that caught a lot of attention, I'll tell you about the third one in a minute that just wrapped up, and I'll tell you where we're going next. The first one was a highly controlled environment. We took knowledge workers, right? Put them in a highly controlled office environment and administered these cognitive function tests at the end of the day. What these workers didn't know when they were working in our office was that we were changing the air they were breathing. We changed the air without them knowing. It's very much like an animal toxicology study, except this time we did it with humans, and we just changed their air in subtle ways. Nothing dangerous, of course. Really, we enhanced the air, right? Brought in more ventilation. Things we were just talking about. Higher ventilation rates, lower chemical loads in the space, lower carbon dioxide concentrations. And controlling for all other factors, how well they slept, if they just had coffee, what their baseline cognitive function's like, controlling for all those other factors, the people who spent time in this optimized indoor environment performed significantly better in nine domains of cognitive function performance. Things like strategic decision-making performance, ability to respond and react to a crisis, ability to seek out and utilize information. So domains that are, I think, will be obvious to anybody listening that are critical to being successful in any really business environment or school environment for that matter. And the key takeaway is that we just manipulated the air in really subtle ways and in ways that almost every building can hit right now. We didn't test some exotic condition, you know, some billion-dollar building that could only hit this. It's pretty much bring in a bit more air and, you know, use a little bit less cleaning chemicals in the space. So you have lower levels of what we call VOCs for volatile organic compounds. And that's it. So that caught a lot of people's attention. Double-blinded study published in an excellent journal, fully peer-reviewed. You know, the Cog Effect studies, I think, are 6 or 7 peer-reviewed papers at this point. And the last one we just finished, we took the Cog Effect study global, and we had almost 450 office workers around the world who participated in a year-long study. They all wore a Fitbit so we could track physical activity and sleep. We built an app to administer the cognitive function tests, and everybody got a sensor, an air quality sensor, on their desk so we could record real-time air quality. And so the first set of papers from the what we call the global Cog Effect study will start coming out in the next couple of months.
So fascinating. And I'm curious, so the third, you're going to tell about the results of your third study. What'd you find there?
Well, so those are in peer review right now. They should be out in the next couple of months. So I can't.
Yeah, okay. All right. No teaser. Okay.
What we found just yet. Yeah, no teaser. Sorry.
All right. Well, we'll be watching that very anxiously to see what that shows. But yeah, just fascinating work. And really, you do. I mean, when you think about that over a lifespan and the time that we spend indoors, and you really think our ability to do strategic planning, critical thinking, decision-making, just by extension, the massive impact that has on cognitive ability and overall performance is extensive. So very, very fascinating work. Thanks so much for sharing that.
So we actually took the cognitive function data and said, well, what if these higher ventilation rates were rolled out across buildings in the United States? And we modeled it. And we estimate that the costs are on the order of $10 to $40 per person per year, right? We knew people would say, well, what's the cost for this healthier building?
Yeah.
That's usually where the analysis stops, and it has for a long time. Says, well, that's a cost center, right? We can't do that. But the reality is when we looked at our cognitive function results, we found that the benefit for workers, for knowledge workers, was on the order of $6,000 to $7,000 per person per year against costs of tens of dollars per person per year.
Right.
And I think that speaks to the opening thing we talked about, the 90%. Once you factor in the human health and productivity benefits, it far outweighs any of the costs. The problem is we just haven't factored that in always in our decision making, but we really should.
Do you find that you are seeing more real estate brokers, landlords, real estate folks within corporate settings who are negotiating, you know, with potential building management, that they're starting to ask those questions? Is that now on the radar as table stakes as individuals and companies are making decisions about which types of offices to be in and buildings to put their workforce?
Yeah, there's no doubt this conversation has shifted, and it shifted fast. So prior to COVID, we had a book co-authored with Harvard Business School professor John McCumber called Healthy Buildings, came out in April. Of course, we wrote it before COVID, came out last April, 2020. And there were a handful of organizations thinking about this, but really COVID has forced everyone to think about this. And as you say, these are now table stakes, right? Who is going to go back to a building that's not a healthy building at this point? No one. No one's going to go back, and no one should. And so what's happening is that organizations are now elevating these conversations around buildings and facilities up all the way to the C-suite. And it's even changed decisions on what properties to invest in. And rethinking and rewriting lease terms, right? Maybe a typical lease, say, oh, once a year, we're going to have an indoor air quality assessment. Probably no one paid much attention to it. It was almost a check the box, but not anymore. I've been asked, what is a really robust indoor air quality assessment program rather than a maybe what we had seen before as a kind of a check the box? Sure, once a year we do basic indoor air quality. Not anymore, right? Now it's critically important who verifies that your building is in fact safe and healthy. So yeah, this conversation has just been remarkable, the shift that's just occurred in the last 12 to 14 months.
It's so great to see that the shift is occurring and how important it is for all the reasons you've really highlighted throughout the conversation. I'm curious, though, you mentioned the science, and you also mentioned earlier in our conversation just how few of you there are out there in the world who, you know, commit your life's work to this field. So is the science fairly mature, or do we expect to learn a whole lot more about this in the coming years?
Well, you know, I'd say a little bit of both. So it's mature in the sense that we know what needs to be done to provide people with a healthy building, right? The basics here, better air quality, better water quality, lighting, views, acoustics, thermal conditions. We know this, right? But I'd be a fool as an academic to say we know everything. And the science is always advancing, right? So I think one area that's getting a lot more attention, and rightly so, is this area of healthier materials. So sometimes we build these big, beautiful buildings, and then quite honestly, we pollute them by putting garbage products inside of them. And so we're learning a lot more about, you know, toxic chemicals that are in all sorts of products we put in our buildings, from carpets to chairs to curtains and everything else. So it's mature in the sense that we know enough to act, right? We don't have to wait 10 more years to gather some data before we say we should make changes to our buildings. But at the same time, we should be vigilant and looking for opportunities to continue to advance and optimize health in buildings.
Absolutely. And perhaps you just mentioned a couple here, but I was going to ask you another question about, you know, a future post-pandemic world, which hopefully is not too far out in the future for all of us. Where, you know, should the focus be on, and certainly not just reducing infectious disease at that point, but also other examples of changes that employers can and should be making to their workspaces to promote optimal health and well-being? You mentioned some around, you know, furniture, carpeting, you know, curtains, et cetera. What else would you state that employers should be mindful of as they're designing and building spaces and outfitting spaces really to optimize health and well-being?
Yeah. So I think the most important thing is that as COVID hopefully gets under control in the U.S., that buildings stay a focus before we even talk about what specific factor. So it's not that, okay, you know, we did this interim thing for 12 months to make our buildings safer and healthier, and now we're just going to go back to the old way, right? And going back to normal, it shouldn't be the goal because normal wasn't working. You know, I don't want to get back to January 2020. We weren't doing our buildings right at that point. So I still think it's, again, the basics. And, you know, we think about ventilation and air quality. Yes, we've been talking about better filters, bring in more outdoor air. And if that sounds boring, it shouldn't be. It's good for, you know, seasonal influenza. We've seen higher ventilation rates associated with fewer missed work days, fewer missed school days. And then the cognitive function benefits I mentioned too. So it is some of those basics that we shouldn't lose sight of as we kind of get through COVID here. I do think across all of these nine foundations of a healthy building, though, there are areas for optimizing for health that we don't always think about. That healthy materials area, thinking about the chemicals that eventually get out into air and dust, is an absolute key one you should be focused on. It's the early days of that, but the market is moving, right? We just had a brand new science and engineering complex at Harvard, and we're touting, in fact, leading with the story that we chose healthier materials. And that playbook is now out there, but I see organizations veering from it because it's hard. It's hard, right? It's the early days. It's hard. The early days of green buildings were hard, but that shouldn't be a barrier to going forward here. I think some of these more, let's say, nuanced areas around things like biophilic design, I think are really kind of key. So reconnecting with nature. We've spent decades walling ourselves off from nature and disconnecting from nature, when we need to reconnect. And I think for decades, quite honestly, the field of biophilic design was lots of hand waving. Sounds good, right? We want to bring a plant in. Of course, it's more than plants. It's biomorphic shapes and patterns. But the science has really started to be advanced over the past couple of years. Even some of the work on my own team using VR and augmented reality. And we show that when workers are in these offices designed with natural and natural looking elements and shapes and patterns in these spaces, that people actually perform better, again, on these similar cognitive function tests. But here we focused on creativity. So it's probably something that, you know, isn't always on the radar of a lot of folks. But if we start to think holistically about all these other factors beyond air quality, that's where the big gains happen.
And I know we've been certainly focusing a lot of our conversation today on the workplace and organizational environmental quality indoors. But I imagine the same holds true in any indoor setting, whether that be a mall, an airport, a home, a hospital. These principles hold true in any indoor environment. And we could all apply them to, you know, the situations, whether we're a restaurant owner or a homeowner. These are all principles that are equally applicable in those environments as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I love that you bring that up and you're thinking that way. It's 100% correct, right? I think some of the markets where the value proposition is maybe more obvious, for example, you know, worker productivity. Okay, I think commercial real estate gets that and big organizations get it. But you want a healthy home too, right? And now a lot of people work from home, so productivity matters there too. But I also think about when I'm home, I want to relax, I want to rest, I want mental health, I want good sleep quality, and the building influences that. Mm-hmm. Similar with schools, certainly the benefits of indoor air quality. We see relationships between better buildings and student test performance on reading tests and math tests. But it certainly extends to the retail environment, airplanes, automobiles, hospitality, cruise ships, you name it. Everyone is dealing with the same fundamental underlying science, right? How do you improve overall indoor environmental quality for all of these outcomes and benefits? And again, you know, collectively, we spend 90% of our time indoors. We're an indoor species. And where that breakdown happens depends on, you know, your lifestyle. So some of us will spend more time in a school, young kids certainly right now, some of us more at home, some of us more at the office, and some of us spend more time traveling, maybe not so much this year, but probably getting back to a little bit of that soon.
All right. Well, and in closing, one last question for you. What's the one thing or the top one or two things that you would like our audience to know about why healthy buildings are so important? There's so much you've shared, but if you could distill it down to kind of the top one or two things, what would you say?
Well, that's a really good question. I'd say healthy buildings are not expensive and it doesn't have to be hard. So I could say that a bit better, right? I think there's this notion out there that it's too expensive, too hard. It can only be the new shiny buildings. It's not true. Any building can be a healthy building. Second thing is that you're going to be pulled into this movement, whether you lead it or you get dragged into it by other forces. And by other forces, I'll give you two examples. One is top down. We see the large institutional investors already talking about investing in healthy properties and healthy buildings. So there's financial pressures. Two, it's coming from bottom up. Your employees are interviewing your building. People are interviewing their buildings. We have examples of it in our book. Where we see this publicly, people are talking about their buildings. So the demand is coming and COVID just shifted that, right? As I said earlier, who's going to go into a building that's not a healthy building? So you see both the demand there. The last thing I'll say that I think is really quite important is that it doesn't just stop with designing a healthy building. We have to be sure we're taking the pulse of the building. And by taking the pulse, I mean measuring and verifying that the building's performing the way you think it is. There's this new, you know, it's the merging of smart buildings with healthy buildings, these new real-time, lower-cost environmental sensors, which can actually give you a sense of how your space is performing. Because buildings change. You may design it one way, but even weeks or months later, it's going to be different. And you don't know it's different unless you're monitoring that. And I tie that into the question you asked, because this bottom-up pressure and being pulled into this healthy buildings movement for this reason. If you're not starting to monitor and verify the performance of your building, I guarantee the people who use your building are. These sensors, these low-cost sensors, I have one on my desk right here. People have these. It's no longer, well, I have to go hire a specialized firm to tell me that the carbon dioxide level is below 1,000 parts per million. I can do this pretty cheaply. In fact, people are reporting right now on social media, they show, hey, company X, I'm in your building, I'm in your airplane, I'm in your car. Why is it 1,500 parts per million? I've read this study that shows it's bad for my health. It's bad for infectious disease. It's bad for my cognitive function. So this is happening. It's out there. People are not only interviewing their building, they're reporting with data on how buildings are performing.
People are definitely paying attention now more than ever. And if you weren't going to do it for all the right and altruistic reasons to do it, you better do it because people are paying attention and we'll be shaming you on social media if you don't pay attention to it.
That's right.
Well, Dr. Allen, thank you so much for such just a fascinating conversation, the important work that you are doing. Really look forward to seeing how this field continues to evolve and appreciate you sharing your insights with us today.
I really appreciate you having me on. You know, we need these channels to get the scientific research out into the people who are actually making a difference every day in the field. So I appreciate you having me on.
I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Joe Allen, director of the Healthy Buildings Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and author of the book, Healthy Buildings, How Indoor Spaces Drive Performance and Productivity. You can learn more about Joe's work at forhealth.org, where you can also find a COVID-19 risk calculator. I'm Ellen Kelsey, and this is the Business Group on Health podcast, conversations with experts on the most relevant issues facing employers today. If you liked today's episode, please share it with your network and give us a review. Thanks for listening.